attorneys hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very good. We're going to do a little demonstration about how we keep track of time when we're doing oral argument by Zoom. If you look at the upper left-hand corner of your screen, when it's your time to start, I will ask you to go forward, but you'll also see a green start sign. When you have 5 minutes left to go on your argument, you'll see a yellow 5 minute sign. And when it's time to conclude, you will see a red stop sign. I will pretty much hold you to that stop sign and help you remember it's time to conclude, unless you are answering a question of a justice, and then please finish the answer of that question. But after you're done with that, I'll pretty much rein you in. So we will maintain our time in that way. Attorney Stanberry, you're going to be first, and you are on mute at the moment, okay? At least that's what's showing up on my screen. Try talking to me. Attorney Stanberry, do you hear me? Well, I'm not hearing you. I think it's fine for Attorney Loffers to be muted. He's not up yet, but there you go. Looks okay. Oh.
Good morning, Your Honor. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can now. We're fine. Okay,
thank
so
you.
I'll call our second case of the day, Schwab versus Schwab. Attorney Stanberry, please begin.
May it please the court. My name is Carlton D. Stansbury. I represent Kathy Schwab, now known as Kathy Siech, who is the petitioner respondent petitioner in this matter. Also representing Ms. Siech today is Attorney Colin A. Drayton, who is present in the room and is the co-author of the briefs submitted by Ms. Siech. I would like to thank the law firm of Godfrey & Kahn for providing the technology on this end for today's oral argument. They've been very kind to us. In this case, Mr. Schwab agreed to provide a portion of his benefit on a when and if basis, sat back, did nothing, and now argues that he is free to ignore this bargain and obtain a windfall of those benefits that Ms. Siech relied upon in her agreement. The court should know that there are many pensions, notably the City of Milwaukee and the County of Milwaukee, in which a Cudro or another document is not available. And in those cases, the only way to divide those benefits is on a when and if basis. We don't have a military pay order or a Cudro. And that this will impact, the Court of Appeals decision will impact those cases. Because in those cases, based on the Court of Appeals decision, that there's no ability to enforce those when and if agreements after 20 years, the employees, the payers, will be free and immune to ignore the judgment.
Counsel, your opposing counsel says that you could have submitted the proper document, the judgment, to the appropriate authorities with the military to secure the rights agreed to. Do you disagree with that as a factual matter?
Yes, Your Honor. And I can explain it this way. First of all, there was no requirement in the judgment for either party to do a military pay order. But more importantly is that there were elements missing in the judgment that would not allow Ms. Siech to obtain that military pay order. The transcript shows in the trial that there were three things that needed to be provided. One was the percentage, and that was provided. A second thing was the rank or the years of service. And the third was the average pay table or the table used to calculate the benefit. And the court also notes the transcript that there was a dispute of whether or not COLA applied. So Ms. Siech could not have taken the judgment, filled out a military pay order, and submitted it to the Department of Defense because it lacked critical information. And such a requirement that she do so would be essentially adding a term to the contract. The marital settlement agreement or final stipulation in this matter is a contract between the parties. And they did not bargain for that requirement, and we, at this point, can't insert that kind of requirement in this contract. I would also note that the document was ambiguous, and it does reminisce to the case of Washington v. Washington. In that case, the document, the judge's order, as it related to dividing the pension, was also ambiguous. And this court held that the court has continuing jurisdiction to implement that divorce judgment without modifying it and without changing its finality. And I would quote the case on paragraph 14 of Washington v. Washington, that the court said, a final division of property does not always resolve all matters between the parties, and remedial action by the court may be needed to effectuate the objectives of the final division without disrupting the finality of the judgment. And in this case, there was no military pay order, there was no requirement for one, and it did not become an issue until 20 years after the judgment, when Mr. Schwab began receiving the benefits and just did not turn over her share to Ms. Siech.
Did he begin receiving them 21 years after the judgment?
Yes, it was 21
years. In 92, and he began receiving benefits in 2013, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so that's 21 years. So if you're going to do anything, you would have had it done it before he began to receive it, correct?
Or it could have been done when he was receiving it, too. Because
well, that would be more than 20 years, and if he's objecting, how are you going to get to do that?
Well, I believe that he was under an obligation to pay to her her portion that she negotiated to receive.
Right. That's not what I'm trying to get you to focus on. What I'm trying to get you to focus on is his benefit didn't begin until 21 years after the divorce judgment. So if he didn't stick with the judgment and say he's going to pay her 50% of whatever the amount was in 92 when they got divorced, you would have had to do some kind of a legal action to force that, right?
Yes,
so
that's
true.
So
from the moment he began receiving benefits, you're beyond the 20-year period if it's the divorce you're trying to enforce, aren't you?
That's absolutely correct, and that's what makes this judgment and the statute of repose a real problem, because his obligation to pay her commenced after the 20 years of the divorce judgment. And under the Court of Appeals decision, there is no remedy for her and no remedy for people like her whose benefit will not occur until 20 years after the divorce. And in this case,
does our Johnson versus Masters case help your cause or work against you, or neither?
I think it helps, and I think it helps in two matters. First of all, in Johnson v. Masters, they bargained for a quid-ro. And so that was a critical element of the court's decision. In this case, they did not bargain for a military pay order. They did not allocate who was to do it, nor did they provide the information necessary to do it. But more importantly, in the various opinions of the court following the decision, these issues were raised. And there were issues raised about ongoing maintenance obligations, life insurance, college expenses. And this court indicated that those would be enforceable, but did not say specifically how. That harkens back to Hamilton. In Hamilton, when the court said the statute of repose applied to a payment for a collection of child support, this court said, but contempt remains a viable option for aggrieved parties. After Hamilton, the legislature made an amendment which allowed the statute of repose to be extended or set the time frame for collection of child support and family support. But the legislature did not alter the language in Hamilton that said that contempt remains a viable option. And that has been the census, and the consensus is that that's always been available by courts. And it started in Griffin, and it was stated in Hamilton, and it was not even addressed in Johnson because Johnson was not a contempt case. So
can
the court did
just circle back a little bit to what Justice Hagedorn told you. There's nothing that could have been done in the 20 years after judgment to secure her right to receive the payments. Is that correct?
Not entirely. either party could have attempted a military pay order. However, we wouldn't know if that military pay order was accurate until after the judgment reached 20 years. They could have had an argument about the military pay order, but without the information and without the bargain for it, there was no need to in this particular case.
Counsel, couldn't your client have brought a breach of contract action rather than an action to enforce the court's judgment? Because the agreement that the parties reach is just that. It's an agreement. It's a contract. The cause of action wouldn't have accrued until 2013 when Mr. Schwab retired, and the statute of limitations is 6 years from accrual. So your client would have had until 2019 to bring such a claim. And the statute of repose wouldn't have applied because it's not enforcing a judgment. It would be an action on contract, right?
That is a possibility, Your Honor. In this particular case, the judgment, the contract, final stipulation, reserved jurisdiction for the court to enforce. There's a provision that says that the court has a jurisdiction to file contempt to effectuate this document, this judgment, without modifying its terms. So even though it was a contract, the remedy that they selected in their contract was a remedial contempt action within the court. So that was a selection of remedies under a contract.
Where in the party's stipulation does it say that that's an exclusive remedy? Does it say that?
Oh, it doesn't, Your Honor. It doesn't say exclusive remedy. I'll get the language. It does not say exclusive, so I apologize if that was the appendix A25, and this is the final stipulation. It says the parties agree that the court has continuing jurisdiction to enforce but not modify the property division. Specifically, in the event of a disagreement between the parties as to the sale price of a home or other terms of payment of money due under this division, the court has the power to make orders enforcing the provisions of the judgment.
Right, but the problem with that is the very problem that's been presented to the court. I understand the breach of contract claim was not made, but we have to grapple now with the statute of repose, whereas if a breach of contract action had been brought, that statute of repose would not apply because the breach of contract is not an action to enforce the judgment. It would be an action under contract.
Yes.
Are you saying that the parties contracted away the statute of repose?
I think an argument could be made that they did that because they were age 39 at the time this judgment was entered, and they knew that he would not be eligible for benefits until age 60, which is more than 20 years. So the contemplation was that when he retired, she would get her benefits. And with that language in the judgment, I think it can be argued that that is indeed the case.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that the statute of repose can be contracted around?
I do not, Your Honor. I can submit to the court a supplemental brief if that is helpful. But I know from experience, having practiced in this area for 30 years, that these are sometimes the only way that we can divide property when things are not available at the time of divorce. Again, City of Milwaukee, County of Milwaukee pensions, absolutely, they do not accept Kudrow's or any kind of assignment. We're entirely reliant on the payer paying to the payee a portion of that pension when and if available. So while this issue hasn't been in the forefront of many family lawyers' minds, we put in language in the judgments to protect our clients as much as possible, including language about enforcement by contempt always continues.
Mr. Stansberg, let me ask you a question. Are you arguing that we shouldn't be considering the statute of repose in this case because of some of the language in Johnson that it would be unfair and it would lead to an absurd result? Or are you saying that the statute of repose, or are you arguing that as Justice Ziegler just pointed out, that they contracted it away at the time of the divorce, so that's option two? Or are you arguing that if the statute of repose is going to be considered, that it shouldn't have started to toll until 2013 when Mr. Schwab was starting to receive his benefits?
Your Honor, I'm actually arguing those all in the alternative, but I do believe that the primary, the most important argument, and the one that will affect the most people in the family law matter, as well as civil matters, is the idea that the contempt is an inherent and statutory power of the court that cannot be minimized or rendered ineffectual by the legislature. We had this court say in Griffin and this court say in Hamilton that contempt remains a viable option, and that is the integrity of our court system. We simply can't have people who have made an agreement or are ordered to do something in a continuing fashion be able just after 20 years say, I'm free, I don't have to do anything anymore. I think that's the fundamental issue, and it's not an exception to statute of repose. I think that the two blend. And because the legislature did not limit the contempt power of the court in the statute of repose and did not change the statute of repose after Hamilton, then I believe that that is a fundamental power of the court. And it's limited. It's not a broad exception that's going to swallow the rule, because it would only apply to judgments that have continuing obligations. Alternatively, I do think that Johnson is instructive in the sense that in blending the two, if the enforceability of when he started receiving the benefits occurred after 20 years or when he retired, that could be the triggering date analogous to the Johnson case. Maybe the statute of repose begins at that time. And then alternatively, as the justice pointed out, the parties did make a contract. And I think the contract is one that they relied upon. I know that Ms. Seach relied upon it. They gave up things. They traded things in the divorce. And one of them was this ability to get a portion of the pension 20 years because they knew the math. They knew their ages. So I think all three of those support this court's reversal of the Court of Appeals, that as it stands right now, people can just stop working, stop doing anything after 20 years with pure immunity because the court right now cannot hold them in contempt.
How would you define, counsel, a continuing obligation there to distinguish it from, you know, the ordinary case, say, where a court, you know, orders a judgment, right, to be paid, and you know, the court, you know, 20 years, you know, 25 years later, somebody comes to say, hey, I'm gonna, you know, find you in contempt because you didn't pay me the money you ordered to pay me 25 years ago. So yeah, I'm curious how you define that, and I guess as a related question, it seems to me you're arguing some form of a constitutional argument, if you will, that the legislature could not restrict, could not pass a statute of repose that would prevent a judgment like this from being rendered in whatever continuing obligation is. So I'm curious if you could just address those points to me, for me.
Yes. Let me do in those orders. I think there is a money judgment. I'll use a divorce scenario as an example. We frequently have husband shall pay $50,000 to wife within 90 days. That's a money judgment. It's a set amount of time, presumably when the husband was ordered to pay that or when made that agreement, he had the ability to pay. He had to refinance. He has to do something. So that's not a continuing obligation. That's a set dollar amount that exists in the judgment that can be easily enforced in 20 years by simply coming to court for contempt and saying, you paid it, you're late, you owe it. What's different in this case is that there's a promise to pay in the future that's contingent on an event. So in this case, Mr. Schwab's, the contingency was his retirement. His contingency was when and if available. At the time of the divorce, he was unvested. He could have stopped working in the military 30 days after the divorce and gotten nothing. So an ongoing obligation is one that needs a trigger, and that is a continuing obligation in the sense that once he got it, then he'd have to start paying it as he received it. So I think that's the definition of ongoing obligation. In regard to the constitutional argument, in the Frisch case cited by this court said that the legislature cannot render the contempt power ineffective. So, and this court's interpretation, statutory interpretation, is to blend statutes. So if we look at the Frisch case and the statement that the court, that the legislature cannot render the contempt ineffective, and we look at the history of Hamilton and Griffin, we see that the legislature apparently left that alone and is fine with the contempt power continuing despite the statute of repose. The legislature has not changed this court's longstanding view that a contempt power, the fundamental ability of a court to enforce its judgment, continues. I'd like to go back to the Johnson cases, the Johnson v. Master case, that where there was a very robust discussion about the impact of the Johnson case. And the...
Counsel, yes. Yes. I am glad that you turned your focus to that case because it is a good segue to continue the answer to the question posed by Justice Hagedorn, dealing with what is the essence or what is meant by a continuing jurisdiction. And in Justice Prosser's dissent, he responds to that query by giving examples. I point to paragraph 111 of the continuing judgment examples. Then, for instance, a judgment that requires an insured to pay premiums and designate a specific beneficiary needs no additional action by the beneficiary. The beneficiary has a property right and may enforce that right against the insured, or the insured's estate, and the insured violate that right. In the prior paragraph, he's made a distinction about what is a final judgment, nothing else. But also, in other words, the insured may not change the beneficiary more than 20 years after the entry of judgment and expect that he or she has not created a new cause of action.
Justice Bradley, I hate to stop you. I think when your head is turned a little bit from your mic, it's hard to catch every word. Thank you.
Thanks for telling me that, and I'm glad that you're interested in every word rather than my every word.
And you're still not completely clear, at least not to me. I don't know. Perhaps everyone else can hear you.
You're cutting in and out, Justice Bradley.
I think I may have too many internet connections and screens going at this time. That's probably my failure. I'm surrounded by this stuff. Suffice it to say, in paragraphs 1 and 11 and 112, former Justice Prosser gives examples of what this court has declared as the continuing judgments. That those examples are akin to what we have here today. I don't know if you agree or disagree with that.
I think that they are shades of the same. I would note that Justice Prosser wrote Hamilton, and that's the writing where he says in Hamilton that the contempt power remains a viable option. So if I look at his writing in Hamilton and I look at his dissent in Johnson, I think that one could say, especially with Griffin, is that these actions that he brings out could still survive or could still be used under contempt actions. I think that it depends on who the parties are, of course, because if the beneficiary of a life insurance policy is not the party to the law, to the original judgment, then there is an action from that beneficiary. But in this case, we have the two same parties in the judgment who are trying, one is trying to enforce the judgment that they agree to. And frankly, that's in family court, the contempt action is the way that I would say 99.9% of litigants use to enforce the agreement that they entered into or the judgment they obtained from the court after a trial. So the contempt power within the family court is absolutely essential for these judgments to be carried out. Without the contempt action, our divorce judgments will be rendered essentially, holistically meaningless after 20 years. And that simply cannot be the statutory intent, it cannot be the legislator's intent, and it can't be the policy of this court. As going back to continuing obligation, if I look at Griffin, this court defines a continuing obligation as one that does not expire until the parent complies. So in this case, the when and if is ongoing because it doesn't expire until those benefits are either not achieved in the first place or perhaps in this case, Mr. Schwab dies. In that case, then there's nothing more to give. And the court said a parent's failure to pay child support after the child reaches majority is a continuing disobedience of a court order. The contempt is not past, it's ongoing. And when we have a division of property that's a when and if available, then that continuing obligation is relevant because it's not past, it's ongoing, because it doesn't occur until the payer begins receiving the benefits.
Thank you, counsel. Your red sign was up. You looked down.
Oh, I missed it.
You did not have seen it, but it was
up. I'm sorry. Thank you.
No problem at all. Attorney Lockwood, are you ready to proceed on behalf of your client?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay, please do.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Lawfers, and I'm appearing for respondent appellant Paul Schwab. We are asking in this case that the Supreme Court affirm the Court of Appeals judgment upholding the application of the statute of repose in this particular fact scenario. If the court does not affirm the judgment, the possibility exists that the statute of repose really doesn't apply in most family law contexts. And I think the nature of that goes to some of the discussion that we were having before as one of the big issues is what is a continuing judgment? And I think here, this is not a continuing judgment. This is actually a contingent judgment. So what they bargained for was a when and if. That is a contingency that may or may not occur. And that's pretty common. If you think of property as a bundle of sticks, at the particular time of the divorce, what Mr. Schwab had to offer Ms. Seach was an unvested military retired pay order that may or may not vest depending upon the circumstances of what happens in time. Those later events really don't impact the amount of the award because that's fixed. It's a contingent judgment. It's a property settlement. It's just like a life estate or some other types of property settlements that are contingent. You don't affect the amount. I think what the big distinguishing factor in the discussion about what is continuing, I think continuing is modifiability. So if you think about a maintenance judgment or a child support judgment, those things are modifiable. For instance, spousal maintenance, a period of time person could lose their job, a person could die. Same thing with child support. Income can increase, income can decrease. All of those things make it modifiable and make those judgments perhaps more continuing than this judgment.
So I want to push back on your definition in this context. We have no idea what that amount would be, and isn't it modifiable the way you're defining it, depending on how many years he worked? What if he quit 30 days after they got divorced and he didn't get anything? What if he works 5 more years and he gets a certain amount? What if he works 10 more years and he gets a different amount? I mean, how are you distinguishing that from other continuing obligations based on income?
But he's not increasing the amount of the award. What happens after the divorce doesn't impact the amount of the award in terms of what
she received. How could it not? What if he didn't invest at all?
If he didn't invest at all, she would receive zero in that instance.
Right? Isn't zero different than what she winds up, what she's supposed to receive now?
But the question with that, though, is those are events that are post-divorce. And she never took any steps to secure her right here.
Okay, and I want to ask you about that too. There's nothing in this contract that requires her to take such steps. And opposing counsel just described how there would be an inability for the military to reach these conclusions as to the amounts. Had she taken the steps that you're saying she needed to take? So can you respond to that?
Yes, I think that is inaccurate. I think the Washington case is particularly instructive. What we were talking about before is continuing jurisdiction. In that particular fact scenario, I believe the divorce was 1991, give or take, and the parties then brought an action because there was lack of clarity about the language in 1995, before actually there was a retirement. And that's the way it should be done. A military retired pay order would have brought the action. Then there was lack of clarity about it. And then there was some, you know, basically the court helped then interpret that particular judgment. So essentially what she's saying is I can just wait more 25 years, essentially. She waited until 4 years after he retired. So 2017, and then complains, well, I couldn't have done anything before. And I think the fact scenario in Washington demonstrates that's not at all accurate. She had the ability to do that. It muddles, I think, the distinction between continuing jurisdiction and continuing obligation. The court ultimately has the ability to do that. And I actually think there is language within Washington that's particularly instructive about judgments and what the purpose behind the statute of repose is. The court writes in that decision, a significant aspect of justice is finality of decisions, and the law and the court takes this legislative goal of finality seriously. Furthermore, when a marriage ends, the law envisions the parties as having an opportunity to be independent of each other and go their separate ways in regard to their property. I mean, I think that's part of the purpose behind the statute of repose here is that the parties need to have some finality, and the expectation that someone within a 20-year time period takes action to preserve their rights is really important. I mean, what they're really at.
Counsel, I'd like to I want to make sure I understand the argument that you were saying earlier. You were talking about a continuing judgment, something that's modifiable by the court. So I assume that's your answer sort of to the, hey, in 20 years, a divorce, maintenance obligation, you know, maybe could just be dispensed with or something. Reconcile for that, and maybe I'm misunderstanding it. I want to give you an opportunity to clarify where you're drawing these lines, but how does that alternative fit with the language of the statute either? And maybe you can just help me with that. I mean, the statute, you know, says an action upon a judgment or decree needs to be commenced within 20 years after the judgment or decree is entered or be barred. That's the statutory text that we're tasked with interpreting. So even if something is modifiable, does that change whether the judgment or decree has been entered. I suppose maybe if it, you know, it's entered again in you know, 10 years, you know, maybe that changes things. But I'm trying to figure out this theory that you're pointing out of not so much continuing obligation, but continuing judgment or continuing authority to modify the judgment, and how that squares with this statutory text too. I'm trying to make sense of this.
Well, I think here what we're asking for in a property settlement, and it's a difficult line, I understand that, Your Honor, is an action upon a judgment and decree is, in essence, is what is happening here, is that in the judgment decree, there was language regarding that. Whether a maintenance obligation is something that is an action, an enforcement is an action upon a judgment decree is, I think, open. I think the other instance of that is that if it's contractually bargained for, you could bring an enforcement action on a contract. I think secondly, within, you know, with a maintenance or child support, I mean, that isn't really this case. Those are separate fact scenarios. What this case deals with is a person who failed to act for 25 years to do anything in regards to a judgment. That's a distinguishable fact from spousal maintenance or child support. That's a different scenario.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, you know, all cases are different, obviously, but we're talking about interpreting a statute and providing a rule of law that's going to govern. So it does matter to me. I'm quite interested in how this applies to other fact scenarios, because we're going to have to say something that will apply to other fact scenarios. So what is it precisely that you're asking us to say?
What I'm asking this court to say is that when a judgment is entered, a party would have 20 years in which to act on that particular judgment. So in this instance, where there was a judgment entered, in a property settlement scenario, she had her entire 20-year period in which to act. She's asking for equity here, essentially. And equity under the common law doesn't favor a person who sleeps on their rights. Equity favors the vigilant, not those who sleep on their rights. And that's what we had happen in this instance.
There is a provision in the stipulation. It's item number F. It says the parties agree that the court has continuing jurisdiction to enforce, but not to modify the property division. So that was a contractual term that they agreed to. So why do we read that out of their agreement and say now, well, you can't enforce it because I'm going to raise the statute of repose against your enforcing it?
Because the statute of repose provides a period of time in which there's finality of judgment. And
this contract, as you said, and I think as Justice Rebecca Bradley asked earlier, if counsel had claimed for breach of contract, the action would have been timely. And we could, of course, interpret what happened here as a breach of contract as well as an enforcement of judgment, correct?
Well, could we interpret this as a breach of contract? I don't know. I think that depends on the expectations of the parties. I think that hasn't been presented. We don't have any sense of whether there was a breach of contract because that was never the theory of the case that was presented. What this was brought as is a contempt power, a contempt action.
Right.
That, and the contempt action is something that is what they're, I think the contempt action, and I think part another difficulty with this is the contempt action is being used here to try to breathe life into a claim that wouldn't otherwise exist. I mean, if this claim would have been pled out as a contract enforcement, I think we would have had to take evidence on that. That's an unknown how that would turn out.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, that's cool. And answers my question. Thank you.
Go ahead, Justice Krofsky.
Thank you.
No, go ahead, Justice Bradley.
I didn't hear her too. Okay.
counsel, my question relates to what evidence would need to be taken. I mean, I believe your client has acknowledged he has not paid. Is that correct, under his pension?
Has he acknowledged he's not paid? I believe that the evidence is that he's not paid, yes.
Okay, I mean, you can see that, right? There was an order to pay one half the present non-vested value to petitioner when and if it is available to respond in. So your client does agree that his pension has been made available to him, right?
He does agree. I mean, yes, it was made available to him in 2013, correct?
And he has not paid a dime of it to the petitioner, correct?
He has not paid a dime of it to petitioner, correct?
So what possible defense could there be to a breach of contract action?
Well, I think it, I mean, it really, number one, she didn't take any enforcement on this for 20 years. I think here we don't really know what part of it is that there've been so much time that elapsed. So there's questions about COLAs, there's questions about what that looks like. So the problem with not acting upon this within a period of time is that the claims become stale. So
the breach of contract claim would not have become stale because it wouldn't have accrued until 2013 when he actually did start receiving his pension, because that's when his obligation to pay kicked in, right? And there's a statute of limitations of 6 years for breach of contract claims.
Correct. I understand and I hear you, but I don't agree necessarily that the breach of contract, if there was a breach of contract, that evidence hasn't been explored at the circuit court level. The question really was statute of repose, and this was brought as a contempt action. But I think those are different cases. I think what depends a little bit upon how the evidence would come out, what they meant by that particular clause. There's dispute about when and if. So if we were to get into a breach of contract, I think there could be disputes regarding the language. And this was not fashioned as that. This was fashioned as a contempt action. I understand the breach of contract theory, but this was fashioned as a contempt action, which the statute of repose applies.
So you keep saying she didn't take enforcement on it. She didn't take enforcement on it. So what about the situations that Attorney Stansberry described, such as City of Milwaukee Pension, where there is no such enforcement that could be taken? Is it your position that after 20 years, basically someone can put up their hands and say, oh, I don't have to pay because you have no means of enforcing this because of the statute of repose? So how would you respond to that?
Well, I think this case is, it's important to note, is distinguishable from Johnson v. Masters. I think those are more Johnson v. Masters situations. In that particular case, there was a period of time where wife could not act. There's a 7-year period of time. So I think in this case, there isn't that period of time. So I think Johnson v. Masters, where it talks about the period of time and those sorts of things, would apply. I think the second thing is that divorce counsel at the time that they're dividing the asset, quite frankly, should know what it takes to divide the asset. So divorce counsel at the time, and neither of us were divorce counsel in this particular case, should know how to divide a military retired pay order. They should know how to divide the City of Milwaukee pension. So
counsel, just to, before I get too far down that road, your client had the same obligation. He could have gotten a pay order from the federal government, correct?
I don't think that the decree provides an obligation to either party. So, okay.
But well, then why are you throwing it up that she did something inappropriate or lacking in some way when he could have done the same thing and it was his pension?
I am not saying that she did anything inappropriate, but she's the person that would benefit from the particular.
But my question was, he could have gotten the same order, correct?
But if he gotten the same order, he could have applied for the same order, yes.
Oh, okay.
But I don't think it's his obligation to do that. She benefits from the asset as well. And the statute of repose, I think we're getting into equity considerations, and equity, you know, doesn't really benefit people who sleep on their rights. So
does it benefit someone who keeps something that he's agreed belongs to someone else?
Does equity, well, the thing is that I think the testimony at trial talked about that he simply forgot about it. So
if something doesn't happen for 20 years and we have all of these cases where things kind of pop up, then that presents a problem for divorce counsel, because you're going to have cases and areas where things occur over time. So I understand where the court is coming from, where Your Honor is coming from, but it's not, the statute of repose still applies. The language doesn't, you know, what we're kind of talking about is we're kind of getting into kind of discretion and what does court's discretion look like in this particular instance. And the statute of repose is pretty clear. It says within 20 years or shall be barred with an entry of a judgment. So I understand that, but the testimony here was that he forgot. I think Judge Dwyer indicated that was credible. So we're talking about people here where nothing happened. And there is a reason that the statute of repose exists, as the court discussed in Washington, is that there needs to be finality of judgment so that the parties can move on from each other. And that's really what the difficulty is here, is that they're linked together because of that, because they really nothing had happened.
Mr. Loffers, isn't it the opposite, really? When these parties got divorced, of course, this pension is marital property and belonged to both of them. And as part of the divorce settlement, she agreed to take only 50% of his pension. And that in order for this couple to go their own ways, one of the things that she would need is financial independence. And so she negotiated at the time of the divorce for 50% of the pension. And now he's not paying her half of that marital property that he agreed to. And what I'm hearing you say is he was under no obligation to do anything because he forgot. He certainly must have been reminded when the first check landed in his mailbox. And what was to stop him at that point from cutting her half of whatever that check was?
But Your Honor, I think when a party goes through a divorce, first of all, we're looking at what the state of mind of him is at the particular time. We don't know that. Second thing is that when parties have a divorce, in my experience from doing divorce work afterwards, they want to move on. You don't sit and necessarily think about all of the aspects of your judgment.
Mr. Loffers, I will tell you, having been divorced and having financial independence is first and foremost on somebody's mind. And that if you know that you are going to get a payout in 20 years, approximately when you are going to be thinking about retiring, that you are going to be planning your future based on that payout. So I got to tell you, I just don't think that your argument holds water, that people just want to get to the end and get divorced so they don't care how the numbers are going to stack up. So therefore, your client could just forget about it and it shouldn't be a big deal and everyone should look the other way.
But the thing is that the statute of repose provided that she had to do that something had to be done within 20 years. That is what the legislature indicated in 893.40. So there was nothing that was done within the 20 years. If the legislature feels that this is inappropriate in this particular instance, the legislature can make that particular distinction.
So let me ask you something that you said early on in your argument, and that is that this is not a continuing obligation. This is a contingent obligation. If we find that it is a continuing obligation, then do you agree with Mr. Stansberry that the statute of repose would not be applicable?
No, I don't. I don't necessarily agree that it would be not applicable. There is no distinction in the statute of repose regarding what terminates and what does not terminate. The statute of repose is very clear that it's a 20-year time bar, and I think Hamilton's instructive on that. Hamilton was a child support modification, and in that particular instance, they had a child support judgment, And in that particular instance, the court here time barred a collection on a judgment 20 years afterwards. The legislature, in response to that judgment, to the Supreme Court judgment, issued a new statute. They amended the statute. If that is the appropriate, and there were questions about equity in that case, if you read Justice Prosser's opinion, and I understand the equity arguments, but in that particular instance, what the legislature did is issued an amendment to the statute. This court's job is to interpret and provide meaning to the statute. It's not necessarily absurd and unreasonable.
What happened? Just in response to Justice Kurowski's question, what was the point of you making that distinction then early on in your argument?
Well, I think it's important because in this particular instance, this is a case, unlike a child support or maintenance judgment, where there was nothing that actually happened on this case for 25 years, and that there would have been the ability to have something happen for 25 years. So here we have a case where judgment was entered, and then not until 2017 was there any pursuit of the judgment. So I think that's important because there had been that length of time. And that makes this case a very stark case in which it is appropriate to apply a statute of repose. If statute of repose is not applied in this particular case, in what case would the statute of repose apply? Because from the instance, from the beginning of the case until the end, literally nothing happened. And there was the ability. I don't think there's been any dispute that there was at least the ability to pursue that. And I think in Washington, in a fact scenario where we have a discussion about continuing jurisdiction, and it's similar in that sense, there was a pursuit of that. And there needs to be an encouragement to do that.
Counsel, could you address, your opposing counsel said with regard to what could be sent to the military and responded and said, no, that would not have been effective in this situation. At least as I understood your opposing counsel's argument he really was not able to do, or I'm sorry, his client was not able to do it. Would you please respond to that argument? I'd like to hear your response to that.
I think that's inaccurate. I think what would have happened is if you would have sent the order to the military, what the military likely would have done if they had a problem with the order like they did in Washington is they would have told the parties what the problems with the order were. And then the parties, and this I think happens on many retirement plans and why they need to be addressed early on, is you send a copy of the order and then they say, well, hey, I have X problem or Y problem. And if that is not addressed within the judgment and decree, and that's a possibility, then the parties would have to bring back an action to have it addressed. And that court has continuing jurisdiction to do that. We're not arguing that the court wouldn't have any continuing jurisdiction to do that, but she had the ability to bring or send something in terms of a military retired pay order and have that addressed.
Did his pension vest?
When he retired at age 60, so 2013.
Okay, so it didn't vest until after 20 years from the date of divorce. So if he had retired from the military a year earlier, he wouldn't have gotten anything?
If it hadn't vested, correct. He wouldn't have gotten anything. If he had to serve long enough within the military for the retirement to vest.
Okay. And so if she would have sent something to the military before the pension vested, which was 2013, why would the military do anything with that at all? It may never vest.
The military, and under their, you know, that's addressed in the brief, but what the military typically will do is they will have that order and they'll segregate the funds. And they do that for very specific reasons. You want to have those orders in. One of the scenarios that I mentioned is it is possible that Mr. Schwab could have remarried within that 20 years and actually divorced in that interim period of time. And there has to be, so then new spouse or new divorced spouse could have submitted an order and leaped in front of this siege, and we'd have a whole new set of problems. So I think the military would have been able to apply a formula. And that's really what you're doing here, is you're applying a formula. That's what the parties bargained for, is a formula. And the numbers and the inputs in the formula can change, but it doesn't, it's important to do that, to take those steps to secure the right. If you don't take those steps to secure the right, all kinds of things can happen. And, you know, it's just like if I have a check from the bank and the check is for $30,000 and I don't cash it, there's a period of time in which to do that. And that's really here what the purpose of the statute of repose is. And we're asking in this particular case, because of the statute of repose is very clear that there's a period of time in which to do things. And in this particular case, there was no action taken, that the statute of repose should apply and the Court of Appeals should be affirmed.
Counsel, how does your argument address this scenario? That is, we see oftentimes a provision in a divorce judgment that, for instance, the husband is to maintain the former wife, the former husband, as the beneficiary on an insurance policy. 20 years pass, he remarries, changes it, the beneficiary to his new wife. Is the former wife just out of luck?
Is the former wife out of luck? I think in that particular instance, she would have an action under the life insurance contract, typically. So I would say that she would have other remedies available, and that's
okay.
That statute of repose is one remedy that it, this particular remedy that is sought, the statute of repose forecloses that remedy. In the life insurance scenario, if that were to happen, I think you could sue on the life insurance contract. I've actually had that suit, and you'd bring that action in federal court, and there I think that would be how you would enforce that.
And if the lawsuit was brought, let's say, in state court 27 years after the divorce judgment, I'm trying to encapsulate a period where the statute of limitations of 6 years on a contract would run, would then the former wife be out of luck?
Well, I think that the statute of limitations on a life insurance changing the beneficiaries, I would say probably 27 years after she would be out of luck. But I think it depends upon how long of a period that she was to remain as beneficiary. Generally, when you name a party as a beneficiary on a life insurance policy, it's going to be for a period of time, such as to secure a maintenance obligation or to secure a child support obligation. So probably from the time that might expire. I think the scenario that would come up is if someone died. So if they died, and conceivably in that particular scenario, she would have, or he, depending on who the beneficiary was, would have an ongoing maintenance obligation or ongoing child support obligation would be how I would.
Okay. Did you get your question answered, Justice Bradley?
Yes.
Okay. Very good. Are you prepared for rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, I am.
Please begin.
I think that it's very interesting that all the focus has been on Ms. Siege from opposing counsel's arguments, and opposing counsel references finality. Well, apparently Mr. Schwab's version of finality is that he gets to keep all of the benefit to himself. That's the version of finality. Whereas Ms. Siege's version of finality is, I agreed, I bargained for half of the portion accumulated during the marriage when and if available. So if this court wants finality, then it's got to honor the finality of the bargain that they reached. And that was to share the benefit and not to use the statute of repose as a convenient ability to actually get out of the agreement. I would also note that reference of breach of contract and enforcement under contempt are very parallel. Under a contempt action, what needs to be proven is that the disobedience of a court order and the party's ability to pay. In this case, a breach of contract, I'm not sure what the defense would be. He gets the contract, he gets the benefit, he doesn't pay, he's in breach of the contract. The court, the family courts, they don't say, you've breached the contract. They say, you're in contempt. So when you kind of hold a civil action parallel with a family action, it's the same, essentially the same elements that reaches the same result. But really the emphasis here is that there are people that have made these agreements, and they're not contingent. They are ongoing. Mr. Schwab's obligation is not to pay once, not when he turns 60 to pay a lump sum. Rather, his obligation is to pay every month he gets the benefit. That can be nothing more than an ongoing obligation. By the very definition, it has to be an ongoing obligation. So as we sit here...
Just a quick question. Under the 10 U.S.C. 12731, I think that the way it works for military personnel is 20 years after of service, and you are entitled to receive a pension. You can't collect it until you're 60, but you are entitled to receive a pension. So people are talking about vesting and things like that, but 1 year after their divorce, he had the entitlement to the pension. Did your client have any duty to do anything to try to secure her right to that part of the pension?
Under the divorce judgment, there was not a duty assigned to her to follow up with the military pay order. The court in this case found that neither party were aware of the order. That was a finding of this court. And the court also found that there was no obligation by either party to do so. Now, in the Johnson case, I think the court specified that the recipient in that case had a duty to get the Cudro. I didn't see the judgment in the Johnson case, but in this case, there is no such obligation, and the trial court in this case found that as a matter of fact. So, right now, we're in a situation where the Court of Appeals decision, as it stands, can be construed that any person with an obligation in a divorce judgment or any other judgment, it doesn't have to be divorce, that starts after 20 years or commences before 20 years and goes past 20 years can stop without any risk of being held in contempt of court. And that consequence makes these judgments strategic. They look timed, they can be timed, and they result in one party being completely deprived of what they got in a trial or what they bargained for in the contract that was incorporated into the judgment of divorce. The result of this case is unfair to Ms. Seach, and it's unfair to all of those litigants that are in exactly her same position. And this case will come up again, and the result of this case will have attorneys advising their clients to follow the law. And right now, that's not good for people who are relying on these if and when obligations. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for a very interesting case. We don't have many divorce cases that we take. So it's a little change of pace for the court. The court will meet in closed conference at 1 o'clock, and we are now adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if the mic's on. So.